Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 4th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Gilead, a novel by Marilyn Robinson, presented by Dorothy Bass. Let's listen in.
Called Gilead by Marilyn Robinson. Let me start by asking how many of you have read this novel? Okay. Welcome. We're raising our hand to say whether we've read this novel yet or not. No. Now, here's the dilemma for those of us who have. You know, it's a very gentle novel. It's written as a letter by a man whose 77th birthday happens during the course of the book. And he's been a pastor in a small town in Iowa, in occupying the same pulpit that his father occupied. They're Congregationalists. The year is 1956. And when this man was 67 years old, having been widowed 40-some years earlier, a lovely young woman in her 30s walks into his church. Eventually they marry, they have a child. And this novel is set as a letter from the old man to that son who now is 7 years old. And so you start reading and it seems real gentle and real slow. But as you get towards the end, a page-turner element, at least for me, appears. Did you find that to be true? What is going to happen? Right? Before I came out here, did a Google on this book and printed out a bunch of reviews, and quite a few of the reviewers give away the plot. So we can speak that way as well. And if we do, if some of us slip and if some of the page-turner elements come out, I hope you'll forgive us and read it anyway, because a lot of the joy of the book is in the way it's written and the wisdom that I think infuses just page after page after page. I'll give you enough quotations so that you'll understand that. Okay? So I'm going to try to speak as if we're not going to give away that last little end, you know, the final ending, but which really is the resolution of the story of Jack. Okay. But if it slips, there it is. You know, if in discussing it, we find that we need to discuss that. We'll do that. Okay. Now, so this is that. That's a brief description of the book. Not very long. A lovely, lovely book. Marilyn Robinson is a woman, perhaps 60 years old or so, who teaches at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She is a noted critic and especially a noted author of fiction, though this is only her second novel. She also is herself a Congregationalist, what we now would call a member of the United Church of Christ, and is active in her local church. And her own, I think her own way of seeing the world comes through to some extent in this book. Her earlier novel, which was an award-winning first novel, is called Housekeeping. Has anybody read that? Uh-huh, me too. It's one which I had not, frankly, heard of until Gilead came out. Had you? You hadn't heard of it. No. I recommend that as well, though I think this one's a little more accessible, but I would recommend both of them. That is set in Idaho, and actually the characters were often visiting Wenatchee and Spokane and riding the train through to Seattle. So it's kind of in this region, and in fact, it's set on the shores of a very deep, very cold lake, and I always was thinking of Lake Chelan, though it probably is the one over, is it Coeur d'Alene or
Coeur d'Alene.
Coeur d'Alene, one of probably over there. So that one, if this book is about fathers and sons, and written from the perspective of the older generation, that one is about, I would say, mothers and mother substitutes, and written from the perspective of the younger generation, and where the dominant theme there would be the darkness and of those deep waters, which we learned very early have claimed the grandfather and the mother of our narrator. This book is always taking us into the light. There's lots of imagery of light in this book. when the world is lit up with a very beautiful light. But at the same time, they're both set in very small number of characters, set in little towns in the West. Not as much happens as you might expect in a prize-winning novel, but beautiful, beautiful books that drew me in, I should say, and which were really lovely. Now, this novel, which has been out less than a year now, I think I first learned from the New York Times Book Review, got one of those full cover reviews, which I think I put down and said, I think this is the best review I've ever read of any book. Is that the book I said that? It was just a really strong review. And it went on to win the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award. Which has surprised many people because it's the musings of a pastor. And contemporary literary awards have not, it seems, been going to what you might call Christian fiction. In fact, there's one review that I found which was very wrong-headed, which said, you'll never understand this unless you're a fundamentalist. Because it's got so many biblical images. Well, baloney. I mean, that's just not true. She's clearly not a fundamentalist. She's a very learned woman. And this critic just didn't get that you could appreciate the Bible and theology without being a fundamentalist, as I'm not, and as Marilynne Robinson is not. But still, it's a surprise that to many people, and kind of to me, I guess, that this has won such acclaim and has been very high on the bestseller lists. And in fact, one little review I found, an interview from, this is from Perspectives, which is the journal of the Christian Reformed Church. And they're very asking her some very theological questions, of course. And the interviewer says, has anything about the reception of your new book thus far surprised you? She says, I'm surprised, but I'm always surprised. I've written about Idaho, plutonium, and Calvinism, and now a dying pastor in Iowa. If any writer has ever courted obscurity, surely I have. Her other two books are works of nonfiction. One, a book-length treatment, an exploration of the impact of a nuclear weapons plant in Great Britain. I have no idea how she got onto that. And the other, a collection of essays on Calvinism. I have them all in these bags over here. You can look at them after. It's called The Death of Adam. Very, very interesting. They're very humane, very liberal, open spirit. So I wanted to put forth three hypotheses. This makes my plan. Put forth three hypotheses about why I think this is, has really hit a chord among readers, whether or not they're Christian. And I'll stop and see if you have other ideas of why you think what has hit a chord in you, and what you have heard from your friends and from others. And so we'll stop at that point. And then I also want to raise up some specific ways in which I think it opens the world up for those who are Christian to see the world more deeply, and certain ways in which she draws on really classic central themes of Christian theology and Christian faith as she looks at the world through the eyes of John Ames, this pastor who lives in Gilead, Iowa. Okay, and then we'll look at those images and talk about those as well. And then I'm sure there'll be time for lots of other conversation as well. Okay, why is this hitting such a chord? For those of you who haven't read it, it's hard. Those of you who have will understand. It's hard to pick out just a paragraph or two because they're just beautiful paragraphs one after another, in my judgment. And I read this. I think in January, and then just reread it the last 2 days. And it's been, I see even more, not so much about the plot, but the wisdom that's embedded in these paragraphs. And John Ames, as pastor, he's hardly gone anywhere in his life. He stayed in this little parish. In fact, at one point he says, I think I was afraid if I left I'd never come back. And we'll get to the question later of why he stayed. But he has a capacity to see the world, the beauty that's in the world, and to understand, even though it's mortal and fragile and imperfect, just how beautiful it is that things even exist. So I've chosen one paragraph here that, I hope will help you understand his voice. He's writing to his 7-year-old son, remember. Oh, I didn't mention, he knows he's going to die very soon. He has heart trouble. He's been told that he... Is there anything else I should mention to set up the passages? Have I forgotten any?
Well, he envisions the son reading this at a later stage of the son's life.
Right.
So he wants a voice with his son after he's dead,
right.
So the son then can profit from this wisdom. Yes. So he imagines his son reading the letter at some time in the future, even though the letter itself reaches way back in the past.
Right. He's going to tell his about his own father and grandfather. But he's writing to an adult man. But at the same time, he'll look out the window and say, oh, I see you playing. Okay. So it's there's this time warp.
And that's because he married a younger...
He married a younger woman. They had a child. He was 67 when they met. She was, I believe, let's say... 34, I think I figured out. And they had a child who now is 7. Okay? So, this is just an example of how he thinks about things. I've been thinking about existence lately. In fact, I've been so full of admiration for existence that I have hardly been able to enjoy it properly. As I was walking up to the church this morning, I passed that row of big oaks by the war memorial, if you remember them. And I thought of another morning, fall a year or two ago, when they were dropping their acorns thick as hail almost. There was all sorts of thrashing in the leaves, and there were acorns hitting the pavement so hard they'd fly past my head. All this in the dark, of course. I remember a slice of moon, no more than that. It was a very clear night or morning, very still. And then there was such energy in the things transpiring among those streams, like a storm, like travail. I stood there a little out of range and I thought, it is all still new to me. I have lived my life on the prairie and a line of oak trees can still astonish me. I feel sometimes as if I were a child who opens its eyes on the world once and sees amazing things it will never know any names for and then has to close its eyes again. I know this is all mere apparition compared to what awaits us. He's thinking of his death soon. But it is only lovelier for that. There is a human beauty in it. And I can't believe that when we have all been changed and put on incorruptibility, we will forget our fantastic condition of mortality and impermanence, the great bright dream of procreating and perishing that meant the whole world to us. In eternity, this world will be Troy, I believe. And all that has passed here will be the epic of the universe, the ballad they sing in the streets. Because I don't imagine any reality putting this one in the shade entirely. And I think piety forbids me to try. So even though he's looking ahead to heaven, he cannot believe that this world won't be just always sung and remembered. Someone just lift up that image. What is this about Troy and the epic sun in the streets? What's he referring to? Heaven will be like Greece, they'll be singing about us like they used to sing about the Iliad and the Odyssey and Achilles and Odysseus and all that. Do you get this? That there's an epic. The world, this world may not be, there may be a better world, but this world is so beautiful and so lovely that even there they'll be singing about, they won't forget about it. We won't forget about it. This world is so lovely. And this just happens over and over. He doesn't make things seem perfect, doesn't present himself as perfect, but there's just a real ability to appreciate the beauty that is there in the world around him. One more example from this. Right after this, Lacey Thrush died last night. Isn't that a name? Her mother was a Lacey. They were an old family here, but she was the last of the Lacys, and the Thrushes went on to California. Little town in Iowa is dying. Right? She was a maiden lady. She died promptly and decorously out of consideration for me, I suspect, since she was concerned about my health. The pastor. She was conscious half an hour, unconscious half an hour, and gone. We said the Lord's Prayer and the 23rd Psalm. Then she wanted to hear When I Survey the Wondrous Cross one last time. So I sang and she hummed a little, and then she started nodding off. I am full of admiration for her. She's given me a lot to live up to, so to speak. At any rate, she didn't keep me awake past my bedtime. And the peacefulness of her sleep contributed mightily to the peacefulness of mine. These old saints bless us every chance they get. And that's the thing, that these old saints, and you wonder if in a sense, John Ames is an old saint who's blessing us. Every time he looks out and sees the world in a certain way, we kind of get blessed by that. And also a little self-deprecating humor. He's not setting himself up as the super guy or anything, but a little self-deprecating humor. Now, those of you who have read the book, is this ringing a bell, or are there other examples you'd want to add, or special pages you would have chosen that you want to call to people's attention? Just the beauty.
Well, we don't have the book in front of us, but we discussed this with our book group last spring.
Yeah.
And then the following time we did housekeeping. I was the one that had read it thinking, oh, there won't be that much to discuss, because at that point I didn't think it was as good. I now somehow almost think it's as good, if not the characters even more interesting. But both of those books, the book group, we found ourselves reading out loud to
yes.
each other more than we had with a lot of other books, because her writing
yes.
is glorious. You cannot skim these
right.
books.
Right.
You have to read word for word because you might miss something.
Yeah.
You might miss a word.
Yeah. I have a pastor friend who's read it three times already, just looking, just feeling, I want to be infused with this language. You know, I want to be able to talk
yes.
about the world in this way.
Mm-hmm.
There's one place where Ames says something like, I know all I have, he's in a very trying situation, he says, all I have to do is be gracious. I just have to be gracious. You know, I've had that thought, and we probably all had that thought. But he finds a way of articulating that. It's very beautiful. Yeah. Anybody else want to? We'll get into the more sacramental ones in a few minutes. Okay, a second point, I think that it, another reason I think that this has struck a chord, even with secular critics, even with people who don't share this view of the world, the beauty's one, but second, it really does get to core human issues. This is a great writer at the top peak of her craft. And sometimes sometimes you run into a poem or a very, very well-written novel where they're kind of showing off or something. You know, they're not really using it to get into deep human issues. And time and time again, I think that this is getting into deep human issues, partly just a person anticipating death and trying to let go and realizing that he's not going to be able to raise this beloved child, it gives me such joy. And finally being happy after 50 years of sitting around miserable, not always miserable, but just by himself, lonely and really sorrowful after his first wife died. He's gonna have to let go of that. But he really addresses core human issues. And right from the first page, just an example, I don't know how many times people have asked me what death is like, sometimes when they were only an hour or two from finding out for themselves. Even when I was a very young man, people as old as I am now would ask me, hold onto my hands and look into my eyes with their old milky eyes, as if they knew I knew, and they were going to make me tell them. I used to say it was like going home. We have no home in this world, I used to say. And then I'd walk back up the road to this old place and make myself a pot of coffee and a fried egg sandwich and listen to the radio when I got one.
as often as not in the dark. Now we have no home on earth, but then he paints this very beautiful little picture, though sad, of where he went. So then this, there are just things peppered through the whole book about how he thinks about dying. And he is confident that God will care for him. He's confident that he will live on in some way. And he thinks about what age will his son be what age will he be when they're together. And it's a hardship on him to be so old now and have this lovely son and this lovely wife. And he imagines they're all being young together in heaven. But it's imagining. He doesn't claim ever to know. It's mystery and just beautiful, beautiful reflections on these matters, which are very, very real to all of us, I think, and to all people, whether they are Christian or not. And this, so I think that would be another part of what's striking chords. She's going right to important things. Any comments here? Do you agree that it's going to kind of core human issues in this novel?
You just addressed something that really stuck with me, which is there's this sort of two parts to his view of life. One is just a great deal of confidence or sort of comfort with faith in something.
Yes.
But yet no particular need to pin that down and be real specific about it.
Yeah.
And that's what was impressive about it, is that there's, you call it musings, but you know, his life wasn't perfect.
Right.
He has lots of questions about things, mm-hmm. and they seem like very honest.
Yes.
Impressions of what it's like to be alive, and yet there's some undercurrent of confidence throughout
yes.
all that. He doesn't have to have the answers, but he knows things are going in the direction.
Very good, very good. And you know, when one of the, thank you very much. And you know, Jack is going to be, I should say, he. John Ames, our narrator, has a best friend, a wonderful man. What's his first name? Boughton.
Something,
Boughton is his last name. He just always calls him by his surname, Boughton. And Boughton has 8 children, but they've been friends from childhood. It's a beautiful friendship. And but although it's been painful for John Ames to go over to his house when it was all full of children, The most beloved among these 8 children is a ne'er-do-well named Jack. Mm-hmm. And it's his coming back that drives the plot and the page turning. Okay, what will they make of this? And at one point, and Jack comes to Ames a few times and tries to talk about something, they don't know what it is, for a long time. And Ames says, faith isn't the same thing as doctrine. So that kind of, he has a faith. And he speaks of the Lord, sometimes meaning Jesus, sometimes meaning God, I take it, in a way that is very palpable. He knows the Lord is there. But he's willing to admit he doesn't know all kinds of things about where we go when we die, or what happens to sinners, or, you know, at one point he suggests it's worse to be dishonorable than a sinner. So he really doesn't know. Yeah.
Well, we're just trying to get our head back around
yeah.
this particular novel. Does he not sort of beat himself because he isn't responding to Jack
mm-hmm.
as he feels a pastor should?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason mm-hmm. is that there's
yeah.
something in between there that he isn't exactly naming. In
right,
between.
Right, right. He never has trusted. Jack was named for him by Boughton.
Surprising.
At the last moment.
At the last
moment.
At the baptism. So John Ames, our hero, our narrator, is standing there with this child in the arm about to baptize him. In fact, we see him baptize almost everyone in the novel. He loves to baptize. This is one of his. He's baptizing this child. He thinks it's going to be named Theodore Dwight Weld. Does anybody know who Theodore Dwight Weld was? He was the husband of Angelina Grimke. Does anybody know who Angelina Grimke was? No? Oh! In 1975, everybody in the room would have known, she was one of the first abolitionist women to speak out. She and her sister Sarah, they were abolitionists. They were the daughters of us. Well, anyway, Theodore Dwight Weld was the great abolitionist who was also an evangelical and a kind of a liberal Christian.
Theodore Breitwald. No. And so he was going to be named Theodore Breitwald Boughton. And standing there, he says, "And what do you name this child?" And the Boughton says,
Johnny Jones.
And this was a shock. And John Ames, the pastor, did this, but he never felt, of all the baptisms he described, he didn't feel it really worked. His heart wasn't in it. He was out of sorts. When Jack comes back to, okay, near the end of the novel, Boughton is dying also. He's very old. Jack comes back, we're not sure why, maybe to visit his dying father. And Jack is just about the age of the young wife, of John Ames's young wife, and is not a man of good character. And we're told various things which show us that since childhood he's not been a boy of good character, he's not been a man of good character from John Ames's point of view. And he's just a little worried, it becomes clear, that this man is going to marry his wife and take this child. And he doesn't know. And let me just, this is one of the other passages I've marked. So our narrator, there's one time where he's taking a nap on the porch, and Jack and the wife and the son are all sitting there talking, and he can kind of hear them. And Jack says to the wife, "Did he warn you about me?" And she says, "No, he never speaks ill of anyone." And he doesn't. But boy, does he think this is, does he have to do a lot of mental internal work to keep from speaking ill, right? So here he's trying to decide, "I have to decide what to tell your mother. He's very nice to her and to you and to me," right? So you look at him as if he were Charles Lindbergh, he seems to be his son. He comes over and plays baseball with him. The father's very frail and old. This makes him feel terrible. He keeps calling you little brother, and you love that. The wife and son are very intrigued that this man is named John Ames. Right? But here's the thing. Here's the typical John Ames mental processing of this. "I hope there's some special providence in his turning up just when I have so many other things to deal with, because he's a considerable disruption when peace would have been especially appreciated. I'm not complaining, or I ought not to be." He's a congregationalist who's looking for special providences. He's hoping maybe there's a blessing even in this difficult situation. But it's hard for him. It's hard for him. Okay? And at one point when he thinks, when he thinks that Jack is going, at one point when he's really worried, he really sees this romance blossoming, he says, I thought I was a holy old man who was ready to die, okay? But my present bewilderments are a new territory that makes me doubt I have ever really been lost before. Though I must say all this has given me a new glimpse of the ongoingness of the world. We fly forgotten as a dream, certainly, leaving the forgetful world behind us to trample and mar and misplace everything we have ever cared for. That is just the way of it, and it is remarkable. So there are some, there are some dark moments as he deals with this, but he always says, "I shouldn't really think this way." He tries to bring back grace again and again, and usually succeeds. Anything else on, just an example of how deeply it goes into, I think, real human issues. I can really, can you picture, you really, there's somebody in your circle you really think, some member of your faculty, or somebody on the church council, or some relative who's really wrecking things. And you've got something on them. You could tell the other members of the council that, or not. Right? I mean, it's a real internal struggle for him. Very real stuff. Third, I'll just say this very briefly. Another reason I think this is hitting a chord with the critics and the general public, I think this book lands smack dab in the middle of the American literary canon, American literature, the classic works of American literature, starting with the poets of New England and through Jonathan Edwards, who's mentioned several times. Ralph Waldo Emerson's mentioned once, but there are certain visionary moments that are very Emersonian. Marilynne Robinson says she started writing this after she taught a whole class on Moby Dick and then got involved with theological elements in New England literature, where she lived before going to Iowa. It goes on and on. Willa Cather, The Prairie, Huck Finn, The Mississippi River, and race relations in the West. The whole theme of the West. The grandfather is an abolitionist who moved to Kansas with John Brown. That's how they got out there in the first place. And he's so disappointed he's just angry and almost crazy the Civil War didn't solve this problem. There's this hope that war will finally bring purity and resolution to this land, and it doesn't. And the last thing John Ames says to his son, I just noticed today, is I hope you will be a brave man in a brave country. I mean, I think it's deliberate too. I think that it's gonna be right in there, but you know, 100 years from now, Scarlet Letter, Red Badge of Courage, I mean, all of those great Gatsby, My Antonia, Gilead, really. I mean, that's my judgment of it. I think that it taps into the same themes that we followed throughout our literature. And since about 1820, it's all been kind of worrying that the American project was over, you know, which is part of the whole thing is this tiny little town. Well, I'm done too much. So then there are also, so these are kind of even literary, almost the general public can appreciate these features of the book, I think. But there are other things I think that Christian readers can appreciate to a tremendous degree. One, it's just infused with biblical language in a very soft and subtle, but very continual way. Secondly, he's always looking for blessings and providence, and he can find a blessing in almost anything. And in fact, his grandfather, who was wounded in the Civil War, was, because he's so old, you see, and it's only 1956, we get back into the whole period of the Civil War for part of the book, when he's found wounded on the battlefield with one eye gone, he says, there will be a blessing in this. You know, and then it almost becomes a family joke. The mom's, something bad happens, and John Ames's mother will say, there will be a blessing in this. But then, actually, by the time he's himself interpreting the world, he really means that there might be a blessing in this. And he's always looking for it.
And the grandfather had a glass eye.
Yeah.
What's Steph mean about that?
Well, I did a little chronology. John Ames would have been born, this narrator was born in 1879. The grandfather was alive until 1891 when he and his father went looking for him, looking for his grave. And so during the 1880s, the grandfather was an old Civil War veteran, abolitionist, John Brown. Described him just like John Brown, the abolitionist would be, going around getting made fun of by children. You know, and stealing things to steal from the rich and give to the poor. So he was a real wild character. And then the father became a pacifist in response. And John Ames is, I think our narrator is largely a pacifist, though that's not quite as much his issue. So.
Now, is this the book also where there's a family on the outside of town? Is there, and they, why do they keep wanting to go out there to help? Do they think one of the babies?
Because it has to do with Jack.
Yeah. It has
Jack's earlier life.
That's right.
Included.
One of the ways we know, one of the ways we know Jack is not a man of good character is that he had an illegitimate child with a very impoverished, illiterate woman whose family lives with a huge gang of barking dogs on the edge of town. And when Ames and Bowton find that out, they go out and care for this baby every Monday, which is the pastor's day off. They go out and care for them until the baby dies at age 3.
And the woman kind of rejects them.
Yeah, the family rejects them.
And I coming from Iowa myself, I was thinking, you know, I swear every town in Iowa has this family.
Yes.
I'm the edge of town, the south side of town.
Yeah, right. Always. Right, and they say, well, we just want to bring him, let us bring him in and give him a good Christian family. I say, we are a good Christian family, right, with the, so, yeah. There's so much going on here. I want to point out, the other thing I want to point, two more things about the Christian view of the world, which will get us a little more into the relations among these fathers and sons, because John Ames, now dying, looks back on his grandfather and his father as he speaks to his son. And one of the key, there's one memory that he has of when he was a little boy and a Baptist church on the edge of town burned down. Remember this? And all the other church people went out to help take down the burned building. And it was a rainy day, and he and the other children were put underneath the wagon that was parked there, okay, while the grown-ups worked in the rain to bring down the burned building. Remember this scene? And he says, it never rains, but I remember that.
There's a Black Baptist church, wasn't there?
There is a Black church in this. There had been a Black church. Yeah.
This was the grandfather's stuff.
Oh, right. I don't think that was the Black Baptist church. There had been a Black church in town years ago, but it had there been a little nuisance fire, they said. But anyway, here we are. Get the rainy scene. It's a day out in the countryside. The children are underneath it's raining. The children are under the wagon. And he says, I remember my father down on his heels in the rain, water dripping from his hat, feeding me biscuit from his scorched hand, with that old blackened wreck of a church behind him and steam rising where the rain fell on embers, the rain falling in gusts, and the women singing the old rugged cross. It was so joyful and sad. I mention it again because it seems to me much of my life was comprehended in that moment. Grief itself has often returned me to that morning, when I took communion from my father's hand. I remember it as communion. I believe that's what it was. I think I may have skipped a key passage, but what he remembers is his father kneeling down, giving him a piece of biscuit with his, and he remembers it that the father put it directly into his mouth. But Congregationalists would never do that. Okay? Congregationalists would never do that. They would eat it in their hand. So then this takes him to move things along. I won't read this, but I remember that day as if my father had given me communion, taking that bread from his side and breaking it for me with his ashy hands. And then he realizes the reason he thinks it was put into his mouth, which it wasn't, was that when his own boy was a toddler, they had communion, and the mother brought him forward and said, you should give him some. And he put it in his mouth. Okay, so he remembers that. And he refers back to this scene again and again and again. And one more spot, which I think is really the key. That biscuit ashy from my father's charred hands, it all means more than I can tell you. So you must not judge what I know by what I find words for. If I could only give you what my father gave me. No, what the Lord has given me and must also give you. So the transfer from the father to the Lord. And he ends up saying, I hope, and this I think is just such a great blessing, I hope you will put yourself in the way of the gift. He says that to his son. I hope you will put yourself in the way of the gift. What the Lord gave to my father, what the Lord must give to you. And then this is I'm not speaking here of the ministry as such, as I have said. He's always afraid he thinks his son will think he's trying to talk him into being a pastor, which he does kind of hope, but which he's not going to come right out and say. And there are also some beautiful passages where water just appears and the children are running through the sprinkler, and he sees that and remembers, and it's as if they're living out their baptism there on the lawn. And he says, when you see something like this, you know that water was made for blessing, not just for growing vegetables and, you know, washing things. It was made for blessing. And so he just sees this out in the world. He sees these sacraments taking place. That's enough. But there's this very, very sacramental view of the world, I think, that comes into play around baptism. When he was a little boy, he went out and baptized. He and Bowden went out and baptized cats. You know? And then their father kind of said something to let them know that wasn't quite right. But let's talk for a minute about this sort of Christian view of the world. And in fact, at one point he says, right worship is the way to the right understanding of God. So I imagine him really working so hard on his sermons and loving to baptize, and then to going out into the world with this kind of vision that he can take with him.
And you even get some sermons now and again in there.
Yeah, yes, you do. Yeah, that's right. The one we get the biggest is Hagar, a father who has to sin, loses his wife and child. This turns out to be an important number. Did you resonate with this book theologically as well,
or
anybody else comment on that?
It's just to say that it's in my mind, and to our group, and we're all theology teachers.
Old men.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, you work in the church very much.
Deep resonance,
uh-huh.
And sophisticated theological reflection, mm-hmm. evident here.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just pap, mm-hmm. and as you said earlier, not fundamentalism.
Yeah, right.
Considerable depth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yet beauty and humor. I love the part where whether he's courting his young wife to be or she's courting him, it's absolutely delightful.
Uh-huh. Yes, it's very funny. He puts on hair tonic. How humiliating!
I like the fact that his wife is not of that church in some ways,
right.
And is somewhat the outsider, and maybe even an outsider to the faith.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yet she will bring him but he loves her so much.
Yeah.
And the sermons sort of things of whether he should save his sermons or,
yes,
you know, are they going to be worth anything for anybody who would read them? And she encourages him to use some of his old sermons so he doesn't have to use his energy writing some new ones.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. I mean just her support of him also. She's never named, is she?
One time.
Is she named?
By Jack.
Okay.
Only one time, and by Jack during that little conversation on the porch.
Okay.
Name is Lila.
Lila, okay, because his first wife was Louisa.
Yes, right.
And the baby, there was the baby.
Mm-hmm.
He lost the child.
Bowden changed the name on that baby, too. They were planning on Rebecca, but Bowden came along and did Angelina because it was early birth.
And she was going to die.
Which may be a reference to Theodore Greitwell's wife.
I would say more of an angel.
Yeah, an angel, too.
But about this young wife, I was just kind of thinking it as a former pastor's wife of sometimes those of us who are a little on the outside can probably bring more to this preacher character than someone who's truly on the inside of religion, because we see things very differently. Would you say that, sir?
That all brings to mind the image that she uses in Housekeeping. The wonderful image, actually, of insiders and outsiders.
Yes.
If you have image of the insider going into a house at night, and you throw on the light, and the windows go dark, and you on the lit inside of the house cannot see out. But people on the outside can see you.
And
that is very interesting to work with. I mean, the outsiders have got insight into the insider.
But it seems to me she uses, or in this novel, like one of the things that's such an image to me is the loneliness of looking inside to a home, and like yours, you know, and thinking there's a wonderful family in there. This is when John Ames was not married, and wanting to be in that household and in that family and couldn't. I mean, I think that is a very strong image for me in that book. And then and then it's talking about, I know the word, but is it, he doesn't use the word covetousness, but he uses a different covet. What is he?
I didn't know his word.
She wrote it.
I didn't look it up either. It was just kind of clear from the... Covetees. Is that a word you've heard before? Anybody?
No, I
haven't. And it means coveting, or being covetous. He's referring to the 10th commandment.
And he felt badly about, I mean, this whole thing of coveting what your best friend has, which is a family. And how that's not good, I think, from his point of view.
And he says, and I have to tell you this, he says to his son, because if I had lived, you would know that you would have gotten some bad examples from me as well as some good ones. And so I just want to put those in the book too, in the letter as well. He's always trying to be humble, really, and I think he is genuinely. Yeah. He says, I didn't really want Bowden's family. I didn't mind having it, but I wanted my own. Mm-hmm. And one reason he has such trouble with Jack, I noticed on this reading, is that Jack has tossed away this wife and child out on the edge of town.
Right. Oh, and he's furious.
20 years ago. Yeah. While he himself would have so loved to have a wife and child. And
I think that he's a tremendously complicated character. I think that you can read the book half a dozen times and see him in different lights. I mean, one of the mysteries of the book is that in the first half, he builds up enormous credibility in your mind because he has such wisdom. And it seems as though his apprehension of the world carries with it an enormous spiritual and moral authority. But then the second half of the book, the sort of page turn part, the question is he reading the world aright here? And it's very important he reads it aright because it has to do with reading his own namesake aright. Now, I'm not going to give the book away, but if he misreads that crucial piece of his life and someone else's, which affects, in his own imagination, the destiny of his own family, what if this man winds up marrying my wife after I die? I mean, that says something very interesting, that his reading there, after having built up this tremendous spiritual and moral authority, may or may not be right. So that's kind of a problem in the book, but that gets then into what kind of human being he is. In addition to spiritual wisdom, there's obviously deep vulnerabilities in this man. Deep grieving, for one thing, for years, and for another. I'll tell this story. We had read the book, and Dorothy, of course, deeply admired John Ames.
This is my husband, by the way. People don't know that.
She deeply admired John Ames. I did too, but we were having one of those late night conversations, and I said, what would you think of me if and I used the euphemism, if something were to happen to you? And we laughed at this absurd euphemism, if something were to happen to you. Oh, and I were to marry one of my present students in college. Well, she said, I think that would be kind of reprehensible, you do something. I said, well, there's exactly the same age difference between John Ames and the woman he married and me and one of my present students. And there was a kind of a shock, you know, that this was true. We did the math, but it didn't have to be right. Then we remembered other things about him. And so what I'm saying is that there's a whole set of vulnerabilities, apprehensions, anxieties, grief, that kind of reinforce in a way and make possible the spiritual wisdom. But it isn't as though this is a man whose spiritual wisdom comes to him easily. I mean, it's hard won, and sometimes he it seems to me, in that crucial case of reading Jack aright, his own namesake, there's some real problems there, which I won't give away, but there's some real issues.
Yeah. Yes, and there's one time when Jack sort of appeals to him, I thought you might understand my life because you have a scandalous marriage.
Exactly.
And he thinks that that he means because his wife is of a different class, her vocabulary is not good, she says ain't, she's trying to become more proper.
Right.
But that's not what Jack means.
Right.
And he can't even hear that. But generally, he's very much, he tries to, even though he is tempted in various ways, he tries not to speak, you know, ill of people. He tries to work it out. He's always asking, I'm worried, I better pray. Or I can't sleep, I better pray. He tries to find a gracious response, don't you think?
Yes.
Again and again. But he clearly can't see the world quite clearly in this case.
And I think also to add to your why this novel has such an appeal, it's not just that it's in the canon, which you mentioned, but I mean it deals in this tiny little world with all of the issues that have been central to American history in a profound way. I mean, through the vehicle of this conflict between the father and the grandfather absolutely believing that violence is necessary sometimes to bring about justice, and that the great work of the Civil War isn't yet finished. The father becoming a pacifist, them parting ways over, in a way, that issue. And the book kind of manipulating you into sympathize with the father, the pacifist, because the grandfather is portrayed in ways that aren't altogether appealing. But then the resolution of the book really raises the question, is there really a balm in Gilead? That is to say, Jack, for reasons I won't get into, thinks he wants to come back there, but is told, well, that just won't work out. And I think I can say he has an interracial marriage. Okay, and so you wonder, well, now, who was right about the unfinished work of the Civil War? Was the abolitionist grandfather right, or was the pacifist father right? And is the work of the Civil War still open? The book is set in 1956, and you wonder, why 1956? Well, it's the year of the Southern Manifesto. It's 2 years after Brown versus the Board of Education. So this whole issue of civil rights is at the front of American consciousness.
Yep.
Exactly. And that's when it's set.
Yeah.
And so you get in this tiny little grain of sand universe all of American history sort of unfolding, at least the central motifs that have shaped it for a century, all present through the memory of this one man as he looks back through his father and grandfather and forward to beyond our time when his son will come of age.
Yes.
So it's in a way a huge book,
even
though it's just kind of a grain of sand focus. It's just an astounding achievement.
Yeah. And race does turn out to be a very important part of the story.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a balm in Gilead? I mean, that the question of why the book has this title and whether there is comfort in this town. Can it receive African-American people? Well, probably not.
Well, they all left.
They all left.
Apparently, there was
a church fire.
There was a time, and we talked about that,
and
because in the book group, I'm the only one from Iowa, and so we were talking about what was the climate of Iowa at one time?
Yeah.
What is the climate of Iowa now? And as I had said, basically, if you are African American, you best go settle in Waterloo, Iowa, because that's okay to do. But it has changed. It was probably much more wide open at one time than it is.
It said over and over that this town and others like it were founded as a place for abolitionists to go and to create free soil, free places where they could help slaves to escape. And so.
Why did the father and mother left, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And never, we should talk, ever came back.
Right. The way Ames ends up in his father's pulpit is that the mother has room. Ames is just out of seminary. He's marrying his hometown sweetheart. His mom, married to the pacifist father, has rheumatism and decides to spend one winter in Florida. And basically they never come back. And he also has an older brother
who becomes a professor of theology or philosophy who has studied in Germany and becomes an atheist. And he turns out to become the son who also is in good touch with the parents. And we learn on only page 6 that at one time John Ames received a letter from his father, the only letter he ever received from his father. And he read it and threw it straight in the stove. And we learn at the very end what that letter said.
Mm-hmm.
Which might be, I think that could be said without.
Yeah, I think that could be said.
Which is, you know, you don't have to stay in that little dump, that town. You don't have to stay in Gilead. And Ames thinks, does he think I have no loyalty? Because he's been staying there trying to keep alive the father's heritage, the grandfather's heritage, and committed to the people around him as well. So does he think I'm a fool, that I have no loyalty to myself, to my work, not to mention to the Lord?
But can you imagine how that must have just crushed him?
Yes.
To get that letter.
Yes.
We get that about three or four pages from the end. Although it's not a big theme. You don't really, it's not a big theme in the book. It's not a plot element.
Yeah.
But isn't that something? So, but is there, there's another reason to ask, is there balm in Gilead? Mm-hmm. You know, is there balm, is there comfort in this town for him, for America, for this son? Any thoughts?
But, well, she ends the book in some ways, though. This whole town does look like whatever hope becomes after it begins to weary a little,
uh-huh.
then worry a little more. But hope deferred is still hope.
Good, yeah.
See, there's the Langston Hughes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I love this town,
he says.
Uh-huh. I think of sometimes of going into the ground here as a last wild gesture of love. I mean, you know, he clearly is. It's a love song right at the end, too.
Yeah.
So in that sense.
I haven't picked that up.
Well, I hadn't either.
And it's a quotation from Langston Hughes, too, which is interesting.
Well, all of a sudden I got that word.
And if there is that sort of feeling, and if a small town can engender that sort of feeling in you, then there is a balm in Gilead somehow.
Yeah. There is his marriage, too, which is a balm, which comes later on in life. But his father is more like the rest of the country, rejecting places like this. They get a television in the very last few pages. The parishioners bring the television so he watches ball games. And the little Lutheran friend of the son is not allowed to watch it. The Lutherans are depicted here as a little bit close. The Lutherans are depicted as a little more conservative than the Congregationalists, a little more closed-minded.
And Boughton is what? Is he a...
He's Presbyterian. Yeah.
Preacher.
Is there a chance to recommend a book?
If
you loved Balm and Gilead. Gilead, excuse me. We're reading this now for our next book group. It's The Solace of Leaving Early.
Oh.
And it's about a pastor in a small town. And the characters are, there are a few more characters, but it's basically a pastor and then this supposedly incredibly neurotic young woman who's brilliant beyond belief, dropout, and two little girls who who witness their father killing their mother and their mother killing their father simultaneously. And it sounds gruesome and grim, and it's glorious. It is glorious. It's another one of these books that we're going to end up reading sentence after sentence to
each other. Who wrote that?
Haven Kimmel, K-I-M-M-E-L.
Thank you. Now, those of you who have read the book, is there something you really wanted to say and share here that I mean, I probably talked too much, and I'm sorry, but I just reread it, and I'm just kind of burning with it.
But you've got to read Housekeeping, then, if you have.
Was there anything Mark pointed out also after we both read it that how much of his life he spends in just depression. Almost. I mean, just kind
he
of.
He says this.
Yes.
In his own voice.
Very sorrowful from years
from the time that wife and child died.
It didn't strike me that much.
No, it doesn't.
No,
that's
it
the,
doesn't.
That's
yeah.
the thing.
Uh-huh.
His own sensibility as it comes through the book
yeah.
doesn't seem depressed.
Mm-hmm.
He says he's depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And all, he describes all of the evenings of loneliness
yeah.
and the baseball games and
mm-hmm.
so forth. And but he doesn't, his apprehension of the world is filled with light and
yeah.
a kind of deep joy in the world.
So
yeah.
maybe he mistakes loneliness for depression.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could be depressed if you're lonely.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
But is
yeah.
he? yeah.
It's a good question.
Yeah,
he's kind of
stuck. But the late, you know, but I rereading it this time, I'd seen many more signs of real connection to his congregation than I saw the first time through. People really, a lot of mutuality with the people in his flock,
mm-hmm.
which I hadn't noticed before. Because as he dies, what he really feels he's going to miss is the church building itself. And that's, there are a lot of moving passages about that. But there's a lot of other little things tucked in that shows people loved him, I think. So, there's so many things, so many more things you could do with this. But it's, I hope you'll read it yourself. And those of us who've read it should keep talking. You can look at the book and show me some passages if you want.
I think it's a way, I mean, you can take it as a devotional in some
uh-huh.
ways and go and read, because I like the way she writes in just short little passages.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, she does some longer pieces, but you can read, you know,
yeah.
takes a while even to read a little bit sometimes, but it's thoughtful
yes.
words so that you could spend a
yeah.
little bit of time a day just reading
yeah.
one little piece of it, and
yeah.
it's over.
Right.
But it connects too. It's not over in that sense.
I'll leave you with a riddle then. That's about the way this literature works, and it's related to this. At one point, he remembers sitting out in a meadow in the summer with his boyhood friend, Boughton, and Boughton says, "Tell me the exact." What the verse would be here, Terry, but man's trouble flies upward like sparks from the fire. Is that about right?
Yep.
And they see fireflies all around. And Boughton says this reminds him of, and they ask the question, did that reality bless the verse, or did the verse bless the
mm-hmm.
reality?
Mm-hmm.
And so as we come to the world with our own vision shaped by the Bible, you know, is the verse blessing the reality, is the reality blessing the verse? See what I mean? It's a concept. And he says, I don't know. But ever since then, I've thought of those together. And, you know, I've loved to think of trouble in that way. So it's interesting.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.